Welcome to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're here with another segment here of the Disaster Podcast, and we're going to be talking about everything we have to think about with different aspects of disaster preparedness and disaster response. And tonight we're going to be talking about mental health of the responders to disasters before, during, and after events. And that'll be coming up later on in this episode. But of course, before we get to that, let's go ahead and introduce our other folks here on the call, including my esteemed co-host, Sam Bradley.
Oh, I so love to be esteemed. Thank you, my esteemed colleague, Jamie. Yep, things are good out here on the West Coast, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
And we're also joined again by our great friend, Joe Holly, Dr. Joe Holly from Paragon Medical Education Group. And Joe, we kind of were brainstorming some ideas for the podcast as we get ideas from ourselves and from our audience and everywhere else. And one of the things that came up was the mental health of the responder. So that's going to be a good topic, I think, to cover today.
Well, I agree. Hello, guys. Good to be with you again. And I think you're right. There's an awful lot of different aspects of the sort of mental health perspective, both, you know, before, during, and after a deployment, not only for the responders themselves, but actually the interaction with the patients in many times who may have special needs and may well be a bit of a challenge in the disaster environment.
So before we get into that, though, I do want to jump in. You know, we try to cover some things on current events and news items that catch our eye and having to do with disaster response and emergencies. And one of the things that came up recently was an article that I ran across talking about the risks associated with being a disabled person in the midst of an emergency situation and how responders really need to help out with that and deal with giving special attention to the disabled people in their communities or in a response zone or whatever the case may be. Joe, I know that in my area, we do a lot of pre-planning, and the local emergency operations center tries to poll the community to ask if any given home has someone with special needs of some sort in it. But I also know that they don't really get a whole lot of response back, and they always wonder how many people are falling through the cracks.
Well, I think you're right, Jamie. And of course, part of the issue with that is that while that information may well be sort of quote unquote on file at the care center, assisted living facility, nursing home, whatever, in the event of a major disaster, those records are often unavailable. And you end up in a situation where you don't really have much information available to you. And it literally becomes a tremendous challenge to sort all that out on the fly.
How prepared are you and your team? You're one of the first people on the ground in some of these situations. How prepared is your team for dealing with people with various disabilities? Is this something you receive a lot of training? I know as an ER physician, you certainly have to be flexible enough to deal with people with a lot of different situations going on. But what about the rest of the team's preparedness?
Well, I think that's a great question. I don't think it's nearly what it needs to be. You know, in many cases in the emergency department, we have access to a lot of resources, whether that be a translator or a patient advocate or, you know, someone from the particular community that's able to speak and communicate for those patients who aren't able to do so for themselves. In the disaster environment, you know, that becomes a huge problem. And our experience has basically been that the community that has problems like that, especially communication related problems, you know, the problem comes down to in the event of an oncoming disaster like a hurricane or something, that you either need to make a decision to get those people out very early, which is obviously expensive and, you know, challenging in many ways. Or you end up being kind of the last people out because the resources are very taxed and You may not even know that those people are there, and they require lots and lots of support infrastructure to be able to get them moved. So they're in a very, very challenging position in the disaster environment for sure.
Sam, what are your thoughts? When you guys come in with the DMAT, obviously you're more of a secondary resource. You're more longer term, and you're there to provide medical care. Do you feel that your team is prepared to handle people with disabilities in an emergency situation in any large way?
I think so, Jamie, because we usually go in with a larger group of people, up to say 50 people. So you have to figure amongst that many people, there are going to be those that are talented enough to speak a number of different languages. I, for one, do sign language. There's people that are, we have, you know, every level of medical provider that probably has some understanding of or some experience with different types of disabilities. So I think we have a higher likelihood within that group of having some people even there. And then, of course, we can look outside into the community for specialized resources. But I think we have a better chance of having some folks within our team that can deal with some of these folks.
Well, I just wanted to just touch base with that. I'll have a link to that in the show notes for this episode, the article that I found. And I urge you in the audience to consider this as something to think about when you plan for response in your area, whether you're a local first responder or you're part of a disaster response team like a USAR team or a DMAT or something, or a Medical Reserve Corps. You should consider what resources are in place and what lists and communication tools there are to get the word out for an early response and an early evacuation of our disabled individuals in the given community. So it's just something to keep in mind, and I just wanted to bring that up. Just thought it was an interesting topic to lead off with this week. But I think it's time for us to get into the main topic, and this week we're going to be talking about the mental health of the responders themselves, and the people that are going into these austere situations, these disaster situations. We've talked about how disaster medicine is not ordinary medicine, and that inherently puts some stress on the individuals that are providing the care and making that response. And, you know, Joe and Sam, both of you have been through numerous situations and helped individuals deal with that. And I have to think that a lot of the mental health of the individual really needs to start with preparing themselves before they ever go out on a response.
You are absolutely right. And I know Joe would agree with me too, because one of the things that bothers me is that people that want to go out and jump into an austere environment with having no idea what they're getting into. And that alone is a stressor, much less dealing with all of the austere environment type things. And you're dealing with people that aren't having everyday crises. They're having maybe lost their family in the flood on top of whatever else is going with them. So I would absolutely agree with that, Joe.
Well, I would agree completely, Sam, that, you know, certainly you have to take care of yourself first in order to be able to take care of anybody else. And, I think for a team that is going out the door in response to a major emergency, that tends to be folks who are fairly type A and are eager to go and assist in any way that they can. But, you know, you sort of compound that with a very austere environment where you're not getting much sleep and there's very few comforts, you know, whether that be the opportunity to take a shower or hot meals or anything else. And after a few days, the responders themselves are pretty stressed out and beginning to have their own issues, and then have to interact with patients who are very challenging, not only because of the environment that they've found themselves in, but that they may well have their own issues to deal with. So, for example, a deaf person or someone who's unable to communicate is really a very problematic patient to deal with in a situation where their infrastructure has been significantly deconstructed, and makes for a huge issue for them to interact.
Right. And I think what you're saying is important, because each of us on the team, now I've done critical incident stress management for many, many years with ambulance people and fire departments and even cops, and as well as our DMAT. But everybody really needs to understand the signs of stress and fatigue and when somebody really needs a break. And then, Joe, that's something that we talked about offline, I think, last week, is recognizing that and saying, okay, this person needs a break. We need to, even if we're busy, we need to get them offline for a while so they can recoup. And I think it's really important for everybody on the team, not only to have training going in to know what they're getting into, but watch out for each other. And when you start seeing some stress showing that you know is not normal for this person, then you need to act on it.
Well, I think you're exactly right, Sam, that, you know, it certainly requires the team to know each other fairly well and pay attention to each other fairly well. You know, there's an awful lot of sort of indirect ways to keep an eye on your team. And I think this is, you know, one of the issues that we'll probably discuss in another episode in more detail, but you know, you certainly look at things like what's the injury rate amongst the team, and you know that tends to be at a pretty steady rate based on the work that you're doing. And then as folks get exhausted and sort of mentally worn down, that rate begins to increase pretty substantially, and that's a very good indirect marker that, you know, maybe the team is kind of reaching their limits of their ability to do the job safely, or safely as it can be done, and that maybe intervention is necessary, including, you know, rest or pulling people offline or whatever.
Yeah, rehab. And didn't you say something about having a log where you can kind of look at trends with different people?
Absolutely. That's certainly one of the things that we do routinely, and that's just a very basic log that keeps up with, you know, requests for, you know, Tylenol for headache and a Band-Aid and the really mundane stuff that you don't think much about. But as you watch that log over several days of a tough deployment, you can certainly see when it, you know, when the rates begin to increase markedly and the complaints for headaches and I hit myself on the thumb with a hammer and all that sort of stuff begin to increase pretty substantially, then you begin to recognize that a lot of that's related to fatigue and exhaustion and lack of focus and you know, the mental stress of being in that environment in the first place. And that, you know, it's a good indirect indicator that the team is nearing its limit.
So do you have people on your team that are in a position to be monitoring that? Do you have mental health trained people that would be the go-to person if somebody said, "Hey, you know, I go to him and I say, look, Joe's having a lot of trouble here. I think he's done." How do you work that within your team? Do you have professionals that deal with that?
Well, on a deployment, that usually falls to the medical specialist, which would be the medics and the physicians that are present. You know, to serve as a screening tool or screening person, as well as you know, the temporary interventional piece. Once we have returned from a deployment, we can engage more professional folks with a tighter focus on the mental health issues to do, you know, debriefing and critical incident stress debriefing, and you know, all the more follow-up kind of issues that would occur perhaps offline. You know, in general, I think during a deployment, it's mostly a recognition that there's an issue and what can we do to reduce the stress levels on that person until we can get them into an environment where we have more resources to be able to take care of them.
Right. And that's an important thing on a larger deployment like some of the ones we've all been on. But, you know, with DMAT, we usually have, what we do is we our roster includes it, people in specific roles, not necessarily specific people, but there's so many docs, so many medics, so many nurses, and there's usually a place for one or two mental health people. And I think it's a good way to do it because you know that those people, their main function is to watch us as well as to interact with the folks there. So, and you mentioned something that's really kind of important, because a lot of you folks out there don't understand differences between defusings and debriefings and so forth. But the debriefing is a really very formal process. And I've been in situations where they have tried to do debriefings, and you can't do that, A, with lots of people, because there needs to be the opportunity for people to talk through what they're feeling, as well as as well as the fact that you can't be in a work mode. If you are still in a work mode where even if you're not physically working out in the field, you know, it's like your shields are up and you're really not going to be able to communicate what you feel unless you've had some space, you've had time to process this incident, and then you might be in a better place to really talk about it and express what you really feel. Is that what you're finding, Joe?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, I think the other thing that's really important is, yet another reason that, USAR and DMAT are a nice fit with each other. It's certainly nice from the field perspective to be able to reach back to a DMAT that's got a deeper level of mental health resources than I do and be able to tie, my person that's having a problem back into them so that, there's a way to get them the help that they need.
Yeah, and I'm sure that interoperability would be there. I'm sure that we'd be more than glad to help out.
So, Sam, I have a question because it occurs to me, in my experience, I've been involved with responding at the local level, and we've had some critical incident situations where we've needed to have a critical incident stress management implemented for a team. But it's been usually around a single event, a death at a fire scene or a child death often triggers these events for our responders. But it occurs to me that at a disaster response where you're there for days, you could deal with several of those each day you're there. And so when you dealing with critical incident stress at a disaster response for your team, do you treat it as one big event, or do you deal with each individual sub-event that has occurred with the individuals involved?
That's a really good question, and the answer to that is all of the above. A good example of that was the New York deployment to Ground Zero. There were 16 of us, and when we talk about triggers in mental health, it means something that's really innate to you as a person. Say we go on an ambulance call and there's an elderly woman in cardiac arrest. Well, most of us realize that happens. Older people go into cardiac arrest. But if your grandmother had just died, that obviously is going to affect you a lot more strongly than it may affect me at the time. So that was the kind of thing we were seeing. One member, in fact, came from New York. So he was having a lot of issues with what was happening to New York. Other people may have those individual issues around what I saw that day, the people that I talked to. I had conversations with firefighters that were really difficult for me, seeing what was going on with them. So we kind of have a general diffusing, if you will, on the bus on the way back into town. But we were close enough as a group where we could kind of communicate with each other as a group. But my job was to kind of watch individual people and interact with them one-on-one when I felt that they needed that, or if I heard, wow, this team really had a bad situation come into their tent. So it's kind of all of the above. You deal with all of it, either one particular person or, say, a team of people that have run into an event. And those are kind of called debriefings because you're kind of – or diffusings, rather, where you're dealing with them on a smaller scale and more – at the time, where your debriefings are your larger events. Like I said, those are very formal events that should really only take place after you're back, after you've had time to process the event, and when you're kind of in a safe haven. I hope that answers the question.
It does. And Joe, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, it's certainly similar, in the USAR environment, in that, the interaction initially may well be kind of a one-on-one thing between the team physician and the person that's having trouble. Exactly as Sam pointed out, recognizing some of those red flags, a change in behavior or withdrawal or, whatever sort of subtle symptomatology you might be seeing. But, your goal there is really just to give them a chance to vent a little bit and to begin to understand what's going on with them. pull them off the line if they need to be off the line, and talk through what they're seeing. And then certainly it's not done there. It's really much more at that point about making certain that when they return to, quote unquote, the real world, they have an opportunity to go through a more formal debriefing with professionals that deal with critical stress management, and make sure that those folks on the team have whatever follow-up they need to restore their mental health back to where they need to be to become functional and members of the team again, or at least back to the work that they have chosen to do.
That's a really important point, Joe. And I remember coming back from New York. It took us weeks to try and assimilate back into normal life, because not life just wasn't normal for us after that. And I think your point is really well taken. There are people, girls are kind of good at, saying what we feel. We cry, jump up and down, and we're over it. Guys, not so much. Guys, unfortunately, have a habit of being macho and stuffing things inside. And those are the kind of people, really, not that girls don't, but you really want to watch them. You want to make sure that they are communicating things that are bothering them. So after they get back, it's just as important to watch them for quite a while after they get back as you did during the deployment themselves, because that's when the real issues can set in if they're not recognized and they're not dealt with. Is do you see that too, Jamie?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that we, just like we would do with any local event, where somebody seems to have really been hit hard by a particular call, we follow them and follow up with them. When I was EMS chief, it was one of my jobs I saw is when I knew somebody was having a hard time was to take some private time with them, make sure they were connected with a healthcare professional, but also as their immediate supervisor was to make sure that I was really trying to get a handle on how they were doing individually and connecting with them on a regular basis to let them know that, hey, I'm here and I'm thinking about you and we need to make sure, you've got everything you need to be the best you can be and to make sure that you get the help you need if you need it. I think that that's, as we've kind of transitioned through the before, the during, and we're into the after. And I think it's important to note that, Sam, as you've told me many times, ground zero is with you every day. You haven't really left it all behind. It's just you've learned to cope with it and manage the stress that you remember from that event. But I know that, just the way you talk about it, that it's something that has affected you and you've had to internalize that in some respect to make it part of you.
That's it. But, there's also good things that come out of every bad situation. And those are some of the things I like to remember, too. And I know that Joe can say the same thing about the Pentagon and some of the other deployments he's been on. We know going in, it's not going to be pretty. We know that. And we know that we're going to come back a slightly different person than we went. But I have to say about Ground Zero, it was such an honor to be there and to put myself in that position, knowing that we'd see things that weren't pretty and coming back feeling very different, but it's okay because we went in accepting that. And that's part of understanding what it is you're getting into. And then we kind of going back to the beginning here, but it helps us help other people that maybe have gone on their first deployment and are kind of shaken up by what they dealt with. But you're right. It doesn't go away, but it's a learning experience. You take the good, you take the bad, and you just put it in some safe place in your brain, and it's there as part of your learning experience, and you're a little bit more prepared the next time, and maybe the next time. And they're all different. I think Joe's found that out, too. Every deployment you go on is very different, and you learn and see and do different things. Right, Joe?
Well, no doubt about that. They are all completely different from each other. I think the other important thing to remember here is that for some people, it certainly sounds glamorous and interesting and fascinating to be part of a response to a major incident. But for some people, it's just not what they signed on for. And I think a recognition that, you know, we had a couple of people that left our team after 9/11 and said, this is just not what I signed on for. And to be able to say to them, we understand, that's perfectly fine, we get it, you know, no problem, and we'll look forward to working with you in the future someplace else, to let them know that they're not a failure. It's just not the right spot for them to be, and that it's important for their own health that they find the right spot for themselves to be in.
And I commend them for the fact that they could make that decision, because we thought DMATS just dealt with natural disasters. We deal with hurricanes and earthquakes and tornadoes. We didn't think that national security was going to be part of what we deal with, but now we do know that. And we signed on as government employees to take care of people, regardless of what situation they're in. And some of us were able to continue to do that, and others could not. Same thing after Katrina, because that was such, in fact, we had three separate deployments to Katrina, and a lot of people said, okay, I'm done. So you got to give them credit for at least recognizing that.
You know, one of the things that occurs to me, and you know, Joe, as we kind of wrap up here, but we talked about, you know, coming back full circle into the preparedness and the training segment of things, and being aware of your limitations and being aware of what you're getting yourself into. And part of that is training appropriately. And I think it's important to note that, again, you know, thank Paragon Medical Education Group for sponsoring the disaster podcast. But one of the reasons we're so happy to have you guys on board is because of the very specialized kind of training you guys put together that help people be better prepared. You can't make them prepare for everything. Like you said, every deployment is different, but you give them better preparedness than your typical PowerPoint lecture and you know, online video class and things like that.
Well, I think you're right, Jamie. And, you know, most of the training that we do is based off of our actual experiences. And we try to pull that in as part of it. You know, it's not for everybody, and it does take some mental preparation as well as educational preparation and physical preparation, et cetera, to be able to perform in those environments. And you know, that's part of what we try to incorporate in the training programs that we offer.
Where can folks find out more about what you do with Paragon Medical Education Group?
Well, you can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. We're also on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group through Facebook. And our Twitter is ParagonMedEDU.
Great. Well, Joe, you know, again, thank you for all of your support and everything you do to prepare your community, as well as help prepare the disaster podcast audience with your input and your insights. We really appreciate your time that you take to spend with us here each week.
My pleasure, for sure.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Oh, the usual social media places. Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, Sam Bradley on Facebook, and certainly at disasterpodcast.com. And I'd like to also add, Joe, thank you for the work you do. As well, I'd like to encourage folks. I mean, if this has stimulated your thinking about getting involved in a team and would like to ask questions of me or Joe or Jamie, or just say, hey, this is something I'd love you to cover on a podcast, please go to the website and throw us up some suggestions. We'd love to hear that.
Definitely. And you can always email us by just leaving a comment on any of the posts there, any of the episodes. Just go to the bottom of each episode. You'll see a comments link there and a little box you can fill in. When you do that, it emails me, and I will make sure the comment and the questions and the suggestions get back to the appropriate people. And we'll leave a response for you as well. And this is important. This is a two-way street. It's a community effort, and we want you to take an active part in shaping what the future episodes of this show look like. We want to make sure we're giving you the information you need to be better at what you do. So please head over to disasterpodcast.com and do that. To find me, you can always look for me under the handle PodMedic anywhere out there if you're looking for me under social media places and things like that. And of course, you can also always catch up with me and my other programs over over at mediccast.com. And of course, the Disaster Podcast is a proud member of the ProMed Network. So you can find all kinds of great medical and response programming over there as well. And I guess that's it, Sam. You know, we've talked a lot about the mental health of the responders here, but it certainly makes it interesting to see what folks are doing out there and how they're dealing with the differences between what response medicine's like in a disaster situation and what regular medicine's like.
Yes, and we could certainly have a much longer conversation just on this topic alone.
So why don't you close us out, Sam?
Well, I think we've made it abundantly clear through this discussion that disaster medicine is not everyday medicine.